You're listening to Nip Tuck Talk Radio, and with me today is Dr. Lance Setterfield, the microneedling guru from British Columbia, and we're going to be talking about the hot topic of microneedling. Please stay tuned for a very interesting episode.
It's a great Cinderella story in that it does offer the opportunity of healthy skin to the many instead of the privileged.
Michelle's goal is to empower listeners and help them make safe cosmetic surgery procedure choices. This fun and lively show explores the world of beauty and cosmetic surgery and features expert guests on a variety of topics. No hype. Your host, Michelle Garber, is here today to help you navigate the confusing world.
This is your host, Michelle Garber, and welcome to another episode of Nip Tuck Talk Radio. If you don't know me, I'm founder of Nip Tuck Coach, an independent procedure consultancy, and I'm a patient advocate. My goal is to help you navigate the confusing world of cosmetic procedures by keeping you safe and well-informed so that not only do you get a great result, but you get the best result. I've also written an ebook called Safety and Beauty. You can download that for free at my website, which is www.niptuckcoach.com. So today we're going to talk about microneedling. There's been a lot of controversy about microneedling. And the controversy is really coming from the medical community in a lot of respects. It's been called the poor man's laser. It doesn't work. There's not enough science behind it. And so we're going to clear a little bit of this up today, I hope. And with me is a microneedling guru, Dr. Lance Setterfield. And we are talking with Dr. Setterfield from Toronto, Canada. Good morning. Or actually, it's afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Lance Setterfield is one of the world's foremost dermal needling experts, is an educator, skin treatment specialist, and international speaker, author of Concise Guide to Dermal Needling. He draws from 32 years of medical experience with special interests in cell-to-cell communication, researching effects of dermal needling on the epidermis and the dermis. Collaboration with companies around the world has enabled him to be on the forefront of this technology. I am very excited to have you with us this afternoon because you really know the world of microneedling.
Thanks, Michelle, for inviting me onto your show and also for helping raise awareness about microneedling.
Thank you. I try to build awareness for safety and aesthetics and the devices and the treatments that are out there. And I talk to a lot of the medical community as well. And I have spoken to the medical community about microneedling, and I've gotten some pros, like it's great, it works better than laser. I've gotten negatives, it's a poor man's laser, as I said before, it doesn't work, there's not enough science. So I want to talk a little bit about what exactly is microneedling and a little insight into why this is such a controversy today. So let's start with what is microneedling.
First, let me just say that I believe it's a great Cinderella story in that it does offer the opportunity of healthy skin to the many instead of the privileged few because it's more affordable. So is it not true that when one's skin is healthy, one will look their best? Is this not what everybody desires? So there are several possibilities to explain why physicians hold the position that they do with regards to microneedling. The cosmetic industry, primarily invested in lasers, etc., is driven largely by excellent marketing. The practitioners, and by that I mean everyone that offers services in this arena, not just physicians, finds themselves trapped in a web, and they often buy into the hype without researching themselves. I know because I fell into that same trap when I first started this path about 10 years ago. I believed the scientific evidence that was presented to me by the companies selling the technology. And after all, if it's new technology, often their evidence is the only evidence that exists. The demand is then created by the industry, and it's propagated by shows like the Oprah Winfrey Show and the Dr. Oz Show. And patients then demand the treatments based fairly often on unrealistic expectations, And then the practitioners feel obliged to follow the trend. And more often than not, that requires a huge capital outlay for the equipment involved. And once they've invested, then the practitioner naturally wants to recoup that loss or that cost of their investment by using the equipment, even when it becomes outdated or potentially associated with higher risk for the patient. Another possible explanation for this is that physicians truly do believe that it's too simple and cannot possibly work. And I too was skeptical when I started this journey in 2005. But I became convinced when the results in my own patients were undeniable. So this led me on the journey of research as to discover how was this possible. And eventually it resulted in my book, The Concise Guide to Dermal Needling. And as you know, time is a commodity that we don't have much of anymore. Demand for care is increasing in the world due to baby boomer and population explosion. And physician numbers are decreasing. So we're really between a rock and a hard place as far as where do we save time. At the same time, there's been an information explosion as well in the past 5 years. So it's really extremely difficult to stay current. And if one were to Google the term dermal needling on Google Scholar, there are over 6,000 results that will be returned. So the expanded version of my book in 2013 represents 3 years of reviewing the literature and distilling things for those who do not have the time to do this. And there are 250 references in my book, which were included, but for every one included, I must have viewed about 20 other abstracts which were omitted. So there really is ample science to support this treatment modality if one will just take the time to have a look at it.
Well, maybe that is part of the problem, is taking the time to look at it and also knowing how to incorporate microneedling into the practice and using it in conjunction with lasers when necessary. I do agree with you that part of it probably has to do with the outlay of the lasers. And if it's not broken, you don't need to fix it. And I think a lot of practices probably look at it like that. On the other hand, consumers are online all the time and they're doing their research and they are hearing about microneedling. So I think the demand for microneedling is going to increase. And I also think that there are, in some aspects, microneedling may be better than laser for certain cases and certain patients. I don't know what is going to happen in the future, but I'm hopeful that more medical practices will incorporate microneedling and that it will become more mainstream. And I think another issue, and we discussed this a little bit, was the estheticians that are being trained in microneedling and how that may also take away from some of the medical practices.
Mm-hmm. I agree with all that you said there. I think physicians are starting to pay attention to this because the estheticians have recognized the effectiveness of this treatment modality. I also think microneedling is being driven largely by the internet, where people are sharing their own experiences and photos and chat rooms and blogs. And so these are not opinions that can be manipulated by either the treatment provider or the industry, and therefore they have more credibility. And so I believe patients will drive the demand for this treatment and physicians will come on board. They have been very slow to embrace this, but I think it's going to be driven from a consumer perspective.
One of the areas I believe consumers need to be careful about is the difference between a medical procedure of microneedling and more of a home derma roller. I think that consumers probably really don't understand the difference, as well as there are many websites that you can go to and you can buy derma rollers. And some of them are medical grade. And in the wrong hands, that's very dangerous.
And this brings back the one of the questions you asked in the beginning, which I didn't answer, is how does needling work and classified? Basically, there are two broad classifications, if you will, cosmetic needling versus medical or professional needling. And this is based on length of the needle. And the length of the needle determines physiologically if the body will follow after the injury. So cosmetic needling has basically been thought by many to only allow more products into the skin. So you get about 80% more absorption of your product depending on the length of needle you use. So if you look at it as aerating the lawn to get the fertilizer in, then that's a basic analogy. But it's not just allowing more product into the skin to support cell function. It is also about injuring the keratinocytes in the top layer of the skin or your epidermis. And this triggers a cascade of signaling systems that nature employs to repair the skin, including producing collagen. So injury to the epidermis is not just fixing the upper layer of skin, but it also signals the dermis to repair itself as well. So it's not just about infusion of products, it's about increasing the signaling molecules that cause your skin to grow. So that's the cosmetic realm. We have no intrusion into the dermis or the body itself. It's a systemic implication directly. It's more an indirect talking to the body from the outside.
If a consumer is using the home version of a derma roller and they're using topical products, isn't it important that they are using topical products that are not going to irritate their skin in conjunction with the derma roller? I mean, it sounds like if you're really asking for trouble.
Yes and no. I mean, I don't want to scare people off, but people also need to have a very healthy respect for what is going on here. And if you consider that most cosmetic products have been manufactured with the idea that they're going to be applied on intact skin, if you are placing molecules that normally wouldn't get into the skin on the skin, and they're being absorbed 80% more than if you just applied the product topically, then you can see how using a roller would magnify hugely any side effects from inactive ingredients, especially that are going to trigger an immune response. So that's what we're starting to see now on the internet, people with horror stories of rashes and swollen faces, etc. So while it is safe relative to all other treatment modalities, there is a risk. It's hard to expect a layperson to understand the technical details of what is in all these products. But buyer beware, companies are promoting products just for the sake of sales, and there's no research that's been done to determine that application of these products.
A lot of people are just drinking the Kool-Aid when it comes to the hype about anti-aging. But going back to the differences between the medical and cosmetic, now there are companies online that are selling what they say medical grade rollers.
You know, a lot of terminology is just smoke and mirrors. Define medical grade. And the real problem in all of this is that this shouldn't be categorized on the basis of the length of the needle, because a 0.5 needle can treat a scar, for instance, and yet in the hands of an esthetician, it's considered cosmetic. And the reason why there is this gray area is that the skin is not one depth throughout. The skin has waves, if you will, where the dermis goes deeper down and then it comes up towards the surface. So a 0.5 for the most part, depending on the area of the body being treated, is staying in the epidermis. But occasionally it does delve down into the dermis in the parts of the skin where the dermis is coming up to the top. So in most states and around the world, 0.5 is considered to be an aesthetician's domain, if you will. But having said that, a 0.5 does have a physiological effect on the skin to treat medical conditions. And this all becomes practicing in within one's scope. And so if one is going to base it on the length of the needle, as opposed to an aesthetician should not be treating medical conditions like melasma, then one gets onto a very shaky ground as far as what does your malpractice insurance cover and what are you licensed to do. So I think there has to be a huge refocusing on scope of practice. And that even goes for physicians. Just because one has a medical degree doesn't mean to say that one is qualified to do medical needling, because this is not something that was taught at medical school. And there are many nuances that one has to learn. So I think additional education is warranted in order to avoid complications, as well as to advance the best results possible in all of this. And it's synergistic treatments, like you said, using the needling combined with the laser or combined with chemical peels, etc. It's not one size fits all. It is an individualized treatment.
What's the difference between the handheld roller and the medical grade?
There's no difference, really. As I say, it's the definitions. A medical grade, I mean, these companies may define medical grade as stainless steel or titanium, etc. So a lot of these devices are manufactured in countries where there is not a lot of regulation and high standards. The quality of the needles, for instance, might be inferior, where you have micro pieces of titanium waiting to break off in the skin and potentially cause scar tissue.
What I was referring to are the pens, not the handheld, but more the pens. There are all these different pens on the market.
Well, now they're handheld pens that are going to be for the consumer to use at home. This becomes a nightmare to try and define, because there's cosmetic, which is home, and there's professional or medical, which is, you know, so if you say medical, then an aesthetician can't do it, but medical could. There's some aestheticians that are allowed to do a 1 millimeter. So this is where things need to be redefined so that scope of practice is clearer. But the long and the short of it is there's not that much difference in the mechanism of how these things work. You make a hole in the skin, that micro injury causes a reaction or a cascade that results in repair. So whether it's a handheld device, a roller, or whether it's a mechanical device where the needles go up and down, you're still causing an injury. And a lot of these companies have tried to create a distinctive difference in order to take a piece of the market, if you will, from the initial devices, which were handheld. You know, there's marketing nonsense that goes on with, oh, an electronic device is better than a roller. There are certainly advantages of a roller versus advantages of an electronic device. There's no device that does it all. So, but each device is, you can sell it on its own merits without knocking the competition and detracting from the scientific evidence of the other device.
I still think, though, that it's really important for consumers to understand when they're being treated for a medical condition of the skin that they should seek a medical professional who has been trained and is skilled in a microneedling process, and not try to do it at home, because I imagine also that there are a lot of infections can occur.
That's a slippery slope. Certainly, if one doesn't know what one is doing and there's more likelihood of infection at home, it's not that it couldn't happen in a clinic either. And I don't want to create the idea that infection is not a concern. But on a broader scale, infection is not the most worrisome or troublesome side effect from needling. That, but certainly there's a lot of do-it-yourself people on the internet. The big problem is that they can purchase these devices, probably even medical devices, via the black market. And I don't know how one stops that. You know, I think people will suffer the consequences of their ignorance. And unfortunately, that muddies the water then for the whole treatment modality based on institutions restricting treatment modalities based on one or two bad side effects in the hands of incompetent or untrained people. And be that a consumer that had no right to do that, or a physician or an aesthetician, or in products that don't belong in the skin.
Going back to the question, a lot of the medical device companies that are marketing to practices claim that they're formulating products. Of course, they want to sell the products and upsell the products to the practices with their needling devices are specific for microneedling. What is your take on that?
I know of companies that are in the process of doing that right now, but I also know of many companies that even defied advice on the ingredients that they were promoting, and there were consequences to them. The practitioners even view the fact that if something is sold to them, that it's registered and legal for sale in the US if it's the FDA. If something is registered, it doesn't mean to say that it's legal. So that is unusual. One doesn't think that that would be possible, but it is, according to the system. But the other thing is, one expects that these companies have done their due diligence, and one can trust the fact that they are giving you something that has been developed with the idea that it's going to be used in combination with needling. But the research that that would require and the cost of submitting that research for approval would be astronomical. So for the most part, these products have not been proven to be safe in conjunction with needling.
So basically you're thinking it's marketing, it's a hype. They haven't been tested, and they're no difference in a brand serum that is a topical that the practice has been using all along.
That's correct. And there's an esophysis, or it's a quote-unquote professional product that it has withstood the tests of time and is safe to use. And I'm afraid those assumptions are incorrect.
So how do you determine then what products are safe to use with microneedling? Is it trial and error?
Well, up until now, it has been trial and error. And, you know, that sounds like a bad thing, but in a way, many good things have come from the advancement of microneedling. It has flown under the radar for so long that we now have a wealth of information that we wouldn't have had we had to go down the traditional road of research and development. And again, because it is relatively safe compared to all the other treatment modalities out there, there haven't been a lot of adverse effects to the detriment of society. I think far more good has come from unrestricted progress. But now we've learned a lot, and now it's time to put the brakes on, because we're seeing where we've crossed the boundaries, and all of the industry needs to respect that there needs to be boundaries here.
What about stem cells? We're hearing a lot about stem cells, stem cell products, PRP, that's been used in the conjunction with microneedling. What is your opinion about all of this? And for those that don't know what PRP is, it's platelet-rich plasma. Want to just explain what that is just for a moment?
The idea with needling is that you poke a hole into the dermis, you break a blood vessel, it stimulates platelets to release their little packages onto the rest of the body. So you've got all these messages that get let out of the bottle, if you will, and go and call for help. So the idea is if you take a patient's blood and spin it down and collect a lot of these platelets and then reintroduce them at a site where you want an improvement in the skin, you have a massive amount of messengers running to call for help, and therefore the first responders, if you will respond in mass, and you will have long-lasting effect. So I am not a huge fan of platelet therapy and anti-aging. It does play a role in hair restoration, in that some of the growth factors and cytokines in platelets make new blood vessels grow. And in that process, more nutrition gets to the hair follicle and the hair grows again. So certainly we see good response to platelet therapy and hair restoration, as well as in sports injuries. If you have a torn ligament, for instance, and you inject platelets into that area, you get an inflammatory response, which results in scar tissue and therefore stability of sorts, which in an injured ligament is a desired effect, but the last thing we want in our face is scar tissue. The other thing is, like I said, the internet drives the market. So real people that have had platelet therapy go out there and comment that their vampire facelift or whatever.
Or those that follow Kim Kardashian, you know, when Kim Kardashian does it, it's got to be good.
Yeah, so, and apparently I heard, and this is a joke I know, but there's a new app that blocks every bit of information about that family, so.
I love it. I'll have to go and check that one out. I know, it's just insane and crazy. But consumers do, you know, that they follow celebrities. A lot of them just follow celebrities. It's crazy. And if celebrity does it, or celebrity says it, oh, then it must be great, and then I'm going to go do it. And that's where they get into trouble. And they've got to understand that just because a celebrity does it doesn't mean that it's right, doesn't mean that it's going to give you the same result, and doesn't mean that you're not going to have complications. And so I think Kim Kardashian's face was all over the internet after she did what they said the vampire
facelift. The companies that promoted the PRP soon realized that the results were not as they expected. And so now they've gone to PRF, which is talking about the white cells and fibrin as a way of making collagen, et cetera. But there's still a lot of debate on this aspect as well. When I was in Monaco 2 months ago at an anti-aging conference, they had 8 platelet PRP specialists. And at the end of 2 hours, these experts were asking more questions than giving answers. And I believe the results we're seeing in that treatment is more from the needling than the added infusion of platelets. So that's the platelet side of things. Platelets only contain inflammatory cytokines, and I believe that inflammation is not a prerequisite for getting a result, and therefore not in our best interests, apart from driving the cost of a treatment up when the added benefits are not reflected in that cost. The stem cells is also controversial in many regards. In North America, one is not allowed to use the actual stem cell. So what they do is they culture the stem cells. The stem cell sends out the recipe for repair, And then they filter all the cells out of the brew and they just keep the recipe for repair and put that in a product. It's not actual stem cells, it's actually just the chemicals, the message system that the cells secrete that they harvest and include in products. You know, nature is about balance. And there's not just one chemical in the mix when there's an injury. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of different chemicals that are all there for a reason and balance each other out. So if one starts taking one or two chemicals that one believes are the biggest players and putting them in a bottle, how does one know how much is enough, number one? And number two is, if one has these things in isolation, then potentially the balance of nature is not going to be reflected. For instance, epidermal growth factor was one of the first growth factors placed in cosmetic products. And it's like a teenager. If it hangs out with a bad crowd, then bad things happen. And if it hangs out with a good crowd, then good things happen. So one cannot just look at things in isolation. And that's why I believe there is still a place for the home rolling and the medical needle. There will always be a place for the medical needling because nature knows best. And when you do these treatments, it releases the cascade as nature intended.
What I hear you saying is that the bottled stem cell products have not been really perfected.
I'm not saying that they're not necessarily a good thing. They have, you know, we will always strive for better. I'm just saying that, you know, some companies that have those products will say you don't need to needle because we put it all in a bottle for you. And I would love for them to be right because I don't like needling myself. I want to, you know, it takes time and it's uncomfortable and I like to go to bed, but
Some of it is hype and some of it may have more science behind it.
I think companies grab onto a good idea that sounds scientific to give them a distinctive difference and they run with it. And the consumer just has to be aware that you can't believe everything you read out there.
Yes, we know that. When I was at AAD in San Francisco a couple months ago, there were a lot of companies that were touting stem cells in their products. And some of them didn't have a lot of clinicals, but they, you know, claim that they've got the stem cells and you really don't know, as you said, how much they have in them. And then what are the other ingredients that the product has and how do they really work together? So I do see that that is still
a question mark out there. And you can have a really, really good stem cell in your product and then some really, really awful preservatives or emulsifiers or fragrance that just destroy all the good things that the growth factor was supposed to do.
Yes, I experience that. There is a skincare product line. I won't mention it on air, but the potential seems like it would be there. However, the fragrance is horrible. It's so perfumey that it's horrible.
That's the only thing I can say. The risk with needling is fragrance and preservatives are the top two contenders for irritating the skin and causing allergic reactions. So people really need to be aware, you know, if there are 5 or 6 preservatives in a product, then you really should consider not using them there. Getting back to the medical needling, I've been advocating only using hyaluronic acid after treatment. It certainly doesn't do all that the skin needs to have it do after treatment, but it has a safety profile that will potentially protect us against lawyers down the road saying we were not prudent in the use of products after treatment. If you introduce ingredients into the skin that don't belong in the skin, they are bound to trigger an immune response, and it might not be on the first treatment. Many of the complications that people are sending to me on the 3rd and the 4th and the 5th treatment. And the irony of it, and if one message can get out today, if you develop a rash after needling, certainly be very cautious about proceeding to the next treatment in the medical realm. The cases of granulomas reported, in most of those cases, there were warning signs that were not heeded, specifically rashes that developed requiring steroid treatment in order to get them under control, and then they proceeded to the next treatment, and then things really got bad after that. Just people need to pay attention and heed warning signs.
Now, microneedling can be used on all different skin types, correct?
So the companies come out and they say it's safe on all skin types, and needling by itself is safe on all skin types. Needling, it is ironic in that if your skin is making too much of something, then needling normalizes it to make the normal amount. And if it's making too little of something, it increases the amount to normal.
So let's talk for a minute about who's the best candidate for microneedling, or is there a best candidate? A lot of people are using it for anti-aging, scars, acne.
Instead of saying who's the best candidate, we should be saying what are we trying to treat? And microneedling is exploding onto the scene predominantly because of the anti-aging side of it. But you will see in the future there are many new indications for microneedling, such as treatment of vitiligo. One can infuse drugs like levulinic acid into the skin to increase the effectiveness of treatment of actinic keratosis or plantar warts. One can infuse steroids into bald patches with alopecia. There's one study looking at infusing artificial melanin into white hairs to facilitate laser hair removal. There are companies like 3M that have developed tape with needles on for drug infusion and immunizations, etc. So there are many more indications that microneedling is now going to find application for, apart from anti-aging, hyperpigmentation, and scars, which I believe are the best indications in the anti-aging department. I don't think there's anything better for treatment of scars than microneedling.
Now, is there a difference between a scar that's either post-surgery or you've had an accident versus an acne scar in the treatment of microneedling?
That leads to the question of what caused the scar in the first place. So in acne, you've got an inflammatory process that's prolonged for a week or two while the infected cyst is there, or sometimes longer, and that leads to the scarring. So typically, the two main reasons for a scar is either an infection, which leads to prolonged inflammation, or an area of the skin where there's a lot of tension. So one has to look at the scar and then determine, was the cause of the scar an infection? And therefore, if the infection is no longer present, then the treatment with needling stands a high chance of success. But if it's in an area where there's still a lot of tension on those cells, then there's a lesser chance of success.
By tension, you mean movement?
Movement, and also sutures on a wound that are too tight. So if you have a massive deficit in the skin and it requires a lot of pulling to get the skin back together again, that tension on the skin is going to cause those cells to overreact and make too much collagen, and hence the scar.
Typically, how many treatments do patients need? Let's say they are treating a scar versus an anti-aging.
How long is a piece of string? So I know you said typically.
Typically, is it three treatments, four treatments, one treatment, two treatments? Just on an average, just to give our listeners an idea, how long are they committed to this process and then the downtime involved with it?
I would say on average, it's going to be 4 to 6 treatments. But it depends on where the scar is, how old the scar is, how old the person is, their lifestyle, their genetics, their nutrition, et cetera, et cetera.
And for your typical anti-aging treatments, someone that's going in that's for anti-aging versus any particular scars or acne scars?
There's no limit to the number of treatments you can have. That's the beauty about microneedling. It's not like you can ever overdo this. You can overdo it in having it done too often. And I'm going to pick up some flack for this because there are some experts that are saying we need to do the treatment once a week in order to maximize the good growth factor called TGFB3. But unfortunately, when you increase the one, you don't do it in isolation. You also increase other growth factors that have a negative impact on the skin, namely collagenase, and that over time potentially can break the very thing we're trying to build up, which is the collagen. So I advocate for treatments once a month for anti-aging. If we're trying to break a scar down, then collagenase is a good thing, and therefore treatment for a raised scar would be done every 2 weeks. If we have an acne scar where there's a depression, then one needs to allow the scar tissue or the scarred area to catch up with the healthy area. So that generally the timing is every 2 months for those treatments.
And what about the lines above the lip? I know a lot of practices are being pretty aggressive with the microneedling as opposed to laser above the lip lines, those smoker lines.
The patients will be happy with this treatment modality if they recognize it also has limitations. And the upper lip lines are areas that results can be limited. And basically it's because those lines are there because the muscles broke the collagen down before it could form. So it would probably be best to treat upper lip lines in combination with a neuromodulator to stop the muscle from contracting while and give the collagen time to build up. So it's almost like putting a broken leg in a cast to splinter to allow time to heal.
That would be some Botox or Dysport in conjunction with the microneedling.
Yes, correct.
What is the downtime if someone is having microneedling done to their entire face?
It depends on who is doing the treatment and what theory they hold to. So if you are of the persuasion that inflammation is necessary to get a result, then those practitioners are going to be more aggressive. They're going to perhaps do a 1 or 2 millimeter. They're going to treat to the point of a massive amount of bleeding, bruising potentially, more redness for longer downtime. I used to be of that persuasion, but I'm getting results with lesser aggressive treatments, only a 0.5 millimeter. My endpoint is not aiming for bleeding. I'm now only aiming for erythema. So the downtime in my patients is much less. They maybe have a bit of redness for 2 days, which is easily covered up with makeup. And they will have a bit of flaking for about 5 days, which is easily addressed with either a enzyme peel on day 3 or 4 and just moisture.
Why would you want bleeding?
Old school thought is that you need a platelet to provoke the inflammation to bring the myofibroblast to the scene to make more collagen. People that are aiming for bleeding are still adhering to the old theory that one needs inflammation, and I believe one can achieve the same result.
Yeah, there's some swelling, correct?
Not in everybody, but a reasonable amount in most people. In patients that have a history of hay fever and asthma, etc., they may have fairly dramatic swelling. So those people need to be warned that when they wake up in the morning, it could be quite dramatic, seeing as their lymph drainage was cancelled by them lying down all night. And if I see swelling immediately after treatment, I encourage why I give my patients an antihistamine to counter that swelling.
Are there any precautions that patients need to think before they do microneedling in terms of medications, vitamins?
Certainly, there's higher risk in some groups of patients like diabetics. It's not that you can't needle diabetics, but they are more at risk for infection. They have impaired wound healing, so one has to be more diligent with follow-up in those patients. Blood thinners are another thing. If you adhere to my philosophy of shallow treatment, then blood thinners are not as much of an issue. Women especially are prone to bladder infections, so they might have the facial needling treatment and then get a bladder infection and not think about it and go and get Cipro at the emergency department. And then they go in burning from the drug. So there are a lot of things to consider in this, and both practitioners, I think practitioners don't appreciate all the landmines there are to step on.
Well, that I definitely agree with. I think there needs to be a lot more education to the practitioners, because if they don't ask certain questions and they don't know, and then their patients have responses that sometimes are very adverse responses.
I'm a pragmatist, right? I'm a physician, but I'm also a pragmatist. And so the reality is that physicians, as I mentioned, already don't have time. Needling takes time. One has to take a very good history in order to ascertain where all the potential landmines are, which includes, coming back to your question about skincare products and makeup and supplements. Most physicians consider those to be irrelevant from a medical history. They don't ask those questions. And so aestheticians have greater training potentially in products and makeup, etc. And they also have the time to invest, not only to do the hard work of history and exam, but also in education. It's about spending the time with the patient, telling them, if you get a bladder infection, please call me before you go on anything. Or if you sprain your ankle, please call me before you take an ibuprofen. So on the one hand, the physicians want to shut the aestheticians out, saying, oh, they don't know what they're doing. On the other hand, the physicians are not willing to spend the time to do the job properly. So what is the solution here? Yes, you could hire aestheticians to work under physicians. I don't really know what the answer is. All I know is that from a patient's perspective, they are going to lose out if the aestheticians are shut out of this picture completely.
Well, that is a big controversy, I'm sure, because as you say, the aestheticians, then that would be taking away business. But I think both industry areas need to work together. There's always so much competition within the aesthetics industry. And hopefully at some point they can just come together and realize that they can help each other, refer each other. But it's all about patient safety too. And if an aesthetician is better equipped to do the treatment, then let the aesthetician do the treatment.
I just got an email from one of my students. She's been to 3 of my classes, and she's done my online course, and she was just reported to her state board for practicing outside of her scope, and it's probably a dermatologist in her area. And ironically, the dermatologist probably knows less about microneedling than she does. You know, ultimately, if this lady gets shut out of the picture, the losers in all of this are going to be the patients.
And I know in California, there's a fine line between the microneedling. It's still a gray area here, whether or not estheticians can actually treat with microneedling if they're in a lone practice and not supervised by a medical professional.
Well, I think the solution to all of this is that all the players sit down and draw up protocols and define scope of practice. And a lot of this will go away. If we all stay within our scope of practice, there's no reason why this cannot benefit everybody.
You mean if the dentist sticks to dentistry and doesn't do Botox or try to get into cosmetic surgery? Is that what you're saying? Or the gynecologist doesn't do tummy tucks and breast augs?
If they have the proper training, my training in South Africa was very broad. And so people become super specialized in areas. But to give a dentist a free hand to open up a cosmetic clinic when they don't know what a keratinocyte and a melanocyte is, and now they're prescribing antibiotics for skin rashes that they haven't been trained to deal with, that's very short-sighted on whoever's part allowed that to come into play.
No, I agree. And a weekend course does not make you an expert.
I concur.
So to wrap all this up, what are some of the questions to ask regarding microneedling and be cautious about before they jump into it?
I think it's not just about microneedling. It goes for anything. If you are going to have a treatment, A, do your own research. Don't trust everything that the person in front of you is telling you. B is, what are the credentials of that person that is about to treat you? If you are being treated by an esthetician who's working under a physician's license, you know, there's one case that I'm aware of right now where an esthetician treated a patient, she developed granulomas. She went back to the esthetician, who then brought in the plastic surgeon, when questioned who trained your esthetician, he said, I did, and clearly he was not in a position to train her. So again, don't just trust degrees on a wall, although, I mean, how else do we really determine whether somebody's qualified apart from the degrees? It's really a gray area, because people get training from other people who have not had adequate training themselves. And so in a way, it's the blind leading the blind. And then they believe that they have been taught all they need to know because they paid a lot of money for this piece of paper.
Well, it's more than just the training. It's also the ongoing training. Do they lecture to their colleagues? You know, it's more than just that piece of paper. It's more than a medical degree.
But this goes for naturopaths and dentists and whoever is doing this treatment. And that's why I think the regulators now have to take a breath. And what's happened is that medical needling has gone out ahead of everybody else under the radar. And now we're waking up to the fact that this is a complicated treatment modality that deserves respect in many regards. And the people doing the treatments have to know what they're doing. It's the bottom line.
I agree. It'll be interesting to see where microneedling goes. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Sutterfield. There was a lot of very useful and very interesting information. And listeners can tweet with you at needlingguide.com. And your book is available on Amazon, Concise Guide to Dermal Needling. And you also have a website for your practice?
Yeah, the book and my online course is also available through my website, which is www.needlingguide.com.
And if listeners have any questions for you, can they tweet them to you?
They can, and I always try to answer, but as time is going by, I'm getting more and more tweets on Facebook and emails, and so I'm not coping, but I will always try.
And your Facebook page is Needling Guide?
No, I think it's Doc Lance Sutterfield.
Doc Lance Sutterfield on Facebook. And your email
is info@needlingguide.com.
Well, thank you. This has been wonderful, and I thank you so much for your time this afternoon. And thank you for listening. And please follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and Pinterest at Nip Tuck Coach, or you can email me at info@niptuckcoach. And remember, you only have one face and one body. Choose wisely. Again, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the NipTuck Coach Radio. Join us next week for another exciting program about the world of cosmetic surgery and beauty. To learn more about Michelle Garber, go to www.niptuckcoach.com. To consult with Michelle directly, call 415-494-7211.